with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 9th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, from the Daily Poster, David Sirota will be joining us to look back on this week in the news. Also on the program later to give me some movie suggestions for the weekend, Film Guy Matthew will be with us. Meanwhile, in Michigan, the Democratic governor, stripped of really any ability to deal with COVID by the Republican legislature, has secured a vaccine surge from the Biden administration. And Congressman Matt Gaetz appears to be headed for some serious legal trouble. It's now looking like Amazon's millions of dollars and intimidation tactics will carry the day in the Bessemer union vote. Washington State Jay Inslee signs a bill automatically vesting voting rights, returning them to former convicts in Washington State. Speaking of governors, the one in Florida, Ron DeSantis, sues the CDC to get cruises sailing immediately. No, thank you. The Republicans are now building an army of poll watchers, which combined with gerrymandering will make Democratic retention of the House very, very difficult. Get some decent news. Despite the pandemic, U.S. suicides dropped last year by nearly 7%. Joe Biden is considering waiving COVID vaccine patents to help almost 100 nations around the globe. And lastly, happy Confederate surrender at Appomattox Day, where Ulysses Grant accepted Robert E. Lee's surrender in the courthouse in Appomattox, Virginia. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Casual Friday. As you can see, I am wearing a soft-collared shirt. May look a little more formal than it will in coming weeks because it's a little chill in the studio today, so I've got a sweater on. Emma Vigeland is out today, feeling a little under the weather. She will be back on Monday. I would also say that turns out not only did the Confederacy surrender on this day. Well, I can't do the math, but it was in 1865. But apparently the South lost the Civil War. So I double checked on that today.
And a lot of people don't know that.
A lot of people are talking about that a lot now. But that's what happened there at that time. We will be talking more about the Bessemer Union vote and David, we will be talking to David Sirota about what's happening with the infrastructure bill and the taxes. And of course, President Joe Manchin, all of that we will cover later in the program. We haven't spent a lot of time. I think maybe there was some of this on Thursday, but the second fun half of the show, talking about Congressman Matt Gaetz. I mean, my feeling about this is Matt Gaetz is a cretin. He may be even worse of a cretin than was obvious to those who were watching him over the past several years. It does not seem to be a huge political implications to what's happening with Matt Gaetz, but that doesn't mean that I can't help but feel like it's nice that there is some type of poetic justice for a guy like this. And it does appear that Matt Gaetz is headed for some serious legal problems. According to the Daily Beast, back in May of 2018, Representative Matt Gaetz sent his friend, the accused sex trafficker Joel Greenberg, $900. And then over the next morning, over the course of 8 minutes, Greenberg used the same app, this is Venmo, to send three young women varying sums of money. In total, the transactions amounted to $900. That's quite a coincidence. But don't believe me. Here's the lawyer. His name is Fritz Scheller. He is the attorney for Joel Greenberg, who I just mentioned, who apparently is pleading guilty and talking to prosecutors. And here's the attorney, Fritz Scheller, for that jail, Joel Greenberg, discussing how Matt Gaetz may be feeling these days.
Does Matt Gaetz have anything to worry about?
Does Matt Gaetz? That is such a
When it comes to what happened today in court,
does he have anything to worry about? And you're asking me to get into the mind of Matt Gaetz, right? And
From your mind.
From my mind.
Based on what your client knows.
Based on what my client knows. Okay. See, I thought if I kept on talking and talking, I would avoid these questions and not to say, I'm sure Matt Gaetz is not feeling very comfortable today. All right? Is that-
That's interesting. Lawyer seems very, very hesitant to talk about Matt Gaetz, but he is quite confident that Matt Gaetz not feeling very comfortable yesterday. I imagine that discomfort is only growing. But we will see. Matt Gaetz may not be long for that House seat. And Republicans, really, you get the sense, had the awareness of this. They have not been sort of rallying around this guy. Even the Trump people have been keeping it at arm's length. Matt Gaetz may be finally time for him to be held to account. But we shall see. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking with David Sirota of the Daily Poster. We'll be right back. First, just a reminder, this program sponsored by SunsetLakeCBD.com. You've heard me talk about these guys for months and months now. They're a farm up outside of Burlington, Vermont. They decided back, I think it was in 2018, they're providing dairy for Ben & Jerry's. Some of them decided to branch off a little bit. And they started to grow CBD. They're doing it with regenerative farming practices. They do it with integrated pest management, so it's 100% pesticide free. They organic fertilizer, and they're also mostly employee owned company, pays $15 minimum wage, and their products are fantastic. And they have a special sale. I don't even know what this. What is? I mean, I'm aware of this. But I don't know where it came about. And I have a feeling Matt might. We are now, it's April 9th. They're having a sale to celebrate 420. And Sunset Lake's 420 sale starts today, April 9th, runs through April 23rd. You can use the coupon code 420 for 30% off your entire purchase. That means 30% of the tinctures, 30% off the gummies, 30% off the hemp flower or the smalls, Matt. 30% off the chocolate fudge. That literally made me get like nervous. and all the other CBD products. You can use code 420 for 30% off. The sale ends on April 23rd, so don't miss out. They also have a new product, CBD dog biscuits. They blended their CBD oil with three simple ingredients, peanut butter, pumpkin, and oat flour, to create delicious biscuits designed to comfort your four-legged friend. The treats each have 5 milligrams of CBD, contain no artificial flavorings or sweeteners. And they are also excited to announce that their colleague, TJ, who I've actually gotten a letter from TJ, he's very nice. The whole crew there are amazing. He is now part owner of the company. TJ spends his days filling online orders, answering customer questions, and blasting the Majority Report live stream through the warehouse. If that's the case, TJ, congratulations on becoming one of the co-owners of Sunset Lake CBD. I know those guys believe that worker ownership is key to creating a more democratic and equitable world. This is for you, TJ. And Matt, do you know what the 420 significance is for that?
Yeah, famously, that's the socially acceptable time to begin smoking in the afternoon. So it's like after school or whatever, you get done, you get finally back to your house or wherever you're with your buddies. That's when you start smoking.
I did not realize that's what it was about. All right, fair enough. So use the coupon code 420 just for the next 2 weeks, ladies and gentlemen, and get 30% off your entire purchase at sunsetlakecbd.com. Also, don't forget, folks are getting vaccinated. It's spring. Maybe you're going out of your house a bit more. Maybe you're going to have meals outside. Well, you do it cautiously, of course. And then what happens? You drop your mask a little bit to eat, but you don't want to keep your mask around your chin while you're eating because you don't want it to get messy. What do? Well, you put your mask in your Comes in Colors pack, or what do you call it? Sack. And the sack has like a clip, or you can have a lanyard on it. You can clip it onto your backpack. You clip it onto your belt loop. Put your mask somewhere clean. And also, I have a problem where I always lose my mask if I don't put it in my Comes in Colors sack. And of course, they also have some amazing masks there. Check out comesincolors.com. Super stylish. At least that's what I've been told by people who understand such things. comesincolors.com. Friend of mine who is making some really nice masks and holders and some scrunchies too. All right. Want to welcome to the program, back to the program. It's been some time. David Sirota. He is the founder and editor. Dave, I'll ask him when he gets here, of the Daily Poster. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too. Now, what is your position at the Daily Poster? I know you launched this thing. Are you the editor, or is that not work that way?
Officially, the title is Troublemaker, Problem Creator. No, and I'm the editor, reporter, player, coach, that kind of thing.
It has been great, and I've been citing your work probably weekly over the past several months that you've been doing this.
Thank you.
And I want to talk about one of the stories that you guys broke months ago that actually had an implication in New York. In fact, there's a whole rolling series of things that I think some of your reporting has created in New York, or at least part of it. And I want to get to that, but I want to talk about what's happening on the national scene. So let's just start with where we are in terms of like Biden has introduced both his one tranche of the infrastructure plan. This week he introduced the taxation plan. It is a little bit pre-negotiated, I guess, relative to where it was during the campaign. Early in the week, the parliamentarian says there can be multiple forms of reconciliation, though I don't know that anybody's clear on really what that means quite yet. And maybe you can help us out there if you have a sense. And then Feinstein says she might be open to the filibuster, and then Joe Manchin closed everything down. Give me your sense of what's going on.
Well, first of all, I always tell people, having worked on Capitol Hill, that people perceive politics, I think they want politics to be House of Cards, but politics is more like Veep. People running around not knowing anything. So the confusion over the reconciliation, the confusion over the filibuster, my view is that there's no grand master plan. It's like everyone, it's just sort of a free for all. I think the notion of the reconciliation being used to do the things that the parliamentarian has already said cannot be done is sort of absurd. I think the entire creation of the idea that you can't ignore the parliamentarian or fire the parliamentarian is actually a level of insanity that even in my own imagination, and my imagination can run wild, it's hard for me to believe that that has now become a thing. Like the idea that the media reports on the parliamentarian as some sort of like, you know, infallible, immovable, like the Democrats put that out there. They use it as kind of like a, oh, we can't do it because of the parliamentarian. And my reaction is that's an eye roll. The parliamentarian is literally an advisor to Chuck Schumer. It's sort of like Chuck Schumer. It is like Chuck Schumer blaming his own advisor if that's what that is. And yet this is now taken as an article of faith that if the parliamentarian says the minimum wage can't be in there or this or that can't be in there, then there's nothing the Democrats can do. It's just not true. It's just false. There are plenty of things that they can do. So my overall view is that short of getting rid of the filibuster or at least limiting the filibuster, yes, you got to then try to use reconciliation for whatever you can use reconciliation for. But if you basically preserve the filibuster and preserve the idea, the fake idea that the parliamentarian gets to decide everything, then you are foreclosing on major initiatives that you have promised to voters. And there's just no way around that.
And that is, and you're doing so in a way that it doesn't sort of, you have an excuse, right? This is an outside force. And if we have to create that outside force, then we create that outside force. I mean, that's, and it feels so. All right. So, and I think that seems clear to me. And I think many people realize that. I mean, you and I have been talking politics probably in this context for, I don't know, 16, 17 years.
Yeah, that's how old we are.
There was, I think, multiple occasions during the Bush administration, maybe at least once, where they got rid of the parliamentarian. They just said, like, you know what? We don't like the way that you're advising us. So goodbye. It's not like it hasn't been done before. And this dynamic of using outside sort of almost like acts of God, like these force majeures, as like, this is why we're not delivering, this is pretty standard fare as it goes. And so but let's talk about what's going on with Joe Manchin. And I think, like, your point that it's more like Veep than House of Cards, I think people really have to understand this. Like they even in the White House, and maybe even particularly in the White House, particularly with Joe Biden, and I want to get to sort of like a broader conversation about this with you, they're just reacting to it's every day is just a series of reactions. What do you make of the op-ed that Joe Manchin published 2 days ago? Because it seems to me that he's just sort of done a 180 on his talking filibuster. Give me your sense of that and why he might have done that.
I mean, I just think this is a nice way of putting it, but I think he either doesn't know where he actually stands. He's actually almost thinking out loud and doesn't actually have a set principle at play. And that's a nice way of putting it. A less charitable way of putting it is that he enjoys being at the center of controversy. He's a narcissist. John McCain, and I'm not, you know, I don't want to stomp on his grave or whatever, but like John McCain was the same kind of way in the Senate. John McCain enjoyed the circus revolving around John McCain. Like, you could argue that like John McCain had relatively a few clear principles, and the principle was that John McCain had to be at the center of the controversy. And so I think Joe Manchin is kind of leaning into being the guy that everything swirls around. Now, what's kind of sad is that The only reason Joe Manchin is that guy is because he's a senator who on the Democratic side is willing to play that role, right? I mean, any individual Democratic senator could play the same role, granted in a different way, but you can take that if in a 50-50 Senate, you need all of the Democratic senators for to pass something, then any single Democratic senator could kind of play this kind of game. Now, it's true that most of the senators say, at least publicly, the Democratic senators, that they want to reform the filibuster. And so Joe Manchin is leveraging his sort of situation to stay at the center of the controversy. And my guess is that part of that is he just likes being at the center of the controversy, right? I mean, like, politicians enjoy attention. The political system self-selects for people who enjoy attention. And then the other question is like, what is he leveraging that for? Like, what actual power is he leveraging that for? And, you know, we at the Daily Poster, for instance, we reported on the tax bill, a related situation. You know, why is he suddenly saying he doesn't want the Biden proposed 28% corporate tax rate? Like, what is that really about? He's sort of saying, first he was like, originally he said, I want an infrastructure bill and I'm for raising the corporate tax rate. But now 28% is apparently some problem for him. He wants it at 25%, which seems unbelievably arbitrary, like the difference between 25% and 28%. So what's that really about? And that's when we reported and we followed the money that he's gotten a significant amount of campaign cash from a particular industry that bet big on the corporate tax rate. So this is a little convoluted, but hear me out. The private equity industry, the Wall Street guys, you know, the Gordon Geckos of Wall Street, after Donald Trump's tax bill lowered the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21, a bunch of these big private equity firms bet big on the 21% corporate tax rate. They converted themselves to C corporations. Okay, and that was a business bet on the 21% a tax rate. They were betting their businesses on that tax rate. They had previously been partnerships. That industry has given a lot of money to Joe Manchin. It's actually given a lot of money to the super PAC that also boosted Joe Manchin. So if Biden raises the corporate tax rate even to 28%, presumably it's not good news for those Wall Street giants that bet big and cannot, by the way, revert back, right? They're locked in. They can't go back to being what they were. They're locked in to a corporate structure that is reliant on this corporate tax rate. So Joe Manchin is essentially going to bat in a very big way for some of the biggest private equity firms in the world. And there's a kind of a sad irony, or maybe irony is not the right word, but like, here's a senator from one of the poorest states in the country who is effectively going to bat for the billionaires, like in a direct way. I'm not talking like billionaires sort of like metaphorically. I'm talking about like literally the moguls on Wall Street, right? The Gordon Geckos on Wall Street, the senator of one of the poorest states in the country going to bat for these moguls. He's not like a New York senator or a Connecticut senator representing some of these guys in Greenwich or living in Manhattan, right? He's going to bat for them to try to keep their tax rates low. And so I think with Manchin, again, I guess it's a long way of saying politics, he likes being at the center of attention and always follow the money, right? The guy's got to raise a lot of money to run for reelection in West Virginia.
That's fascinating. And I will say this, I mean, to be fair, I mean, it shouldn't come as a surprise to people that politicians want to be in the center of things. I mean, and look at what I'm doing for a living. I'm also, you know, I'm just literally sitting here in the center of a set. So I can understand that desire, I guess. And some people it's greater than others. I used to work in show business and it's not hard to find people who want to be, who just, that's their North Star. It's not even a conscious thing. It's just like, if there's an opportunity, that's where they gravitate towards that. And the tax thing is really fascinating because it strikes me as like, if Biden had said 31, Manchin would have said the real number is 28. Right. But the point that you're making here, I wonder if, because it feels like he reversed himself on the filibuster. And the interesting thing about with the filibuster gone, if you're talking like his sole desire was to be that guy, that leverage point, getting rid of the filibuster would make him arguably, and maybe Kristen Sinema, but I think, you know, Manchin, because he's coming from a state where, you know, that's the difference between, let's say, a Joe Lieberman and a Joe Manchin. Joe Lieberman was coming from a blue state in Connecticut, and we spent a lot of time talking about back in the day. Manchin comes from a state that voted overwhelmingly for Trump. I mean, so he at least has some built-in narrative that could justify on some level. But this guy could spend the next at least 2 years anyways, or a year and a half, to be the complete, like, whatever he wants, Joe Manchin could get from the Democratic caucus. But there are times where I think, like, there are some politicians, and maybe there's all the politicians, don't want to be that guy. Like, they don't want to be in a position of making or breaking every piece of legislation that comes by, because they're stuck between two different, there may be some big donors and maybe, like, one of the poorest states in the country. Like, how do you justify these votes? And maybe he doesn't want to take those votes.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good point. And I also think that there's sort of a, I mean, we're sort of circling around this idea that they're always trying to come up with ways to not be held responsible. The parliamentarian, oh, it's not me, it's the parliamentarian. Oh, you know, the filibuster, it's not me, it's the filibuster. And we have to preserve this institution because of, you know, by the way, the nonsensical argument that the filibuster must be preserved to preserve minority rights. Minority, and we're not talking about people of color, we're talking about like the minority of the population, is so absurd on so many levels. Because here's the thing, and this is like not in the conversation, which is to say that the Senate, by virtue of it being two senators per state, preserves significant power, disproportionate power, for the minority of the population in the country, because even at 50 votes, there are 50 Senate votes that can represent a minority of the country that can still block anything in a filibuster-free Senate. So the filibuster actually takes an undemocratic institution, inherently undemocratic, and makes it like insanely undemocratic. But the idea, you hear this all the time, but we have to preserve the filibuster in order to make sure that the Senate remains this special place where minority rights are disproportionately represented. But that's a lot of crap, because a simple majority vote in with all the small states can still stop anything it wants in a 50-50 vote situation. So you're right to ask the question, like, what is Manchin's real agenda? What does he get out of this? And by the way, and I'm not saying that there's a conspiracy here, but like, what does the Democratic caucus get out of pretending or saying that they want to end the filibuster, but having Joe Manchin, them being able to say, well, look, Joe Manchin represents a Republican state. He wants to look like he's bipartisan. We can't get rid of the filibuster. In other words, lots of people are actually benefiting from Joe Manchin trying to stop the end of the filibuster. Even the Democrats who are able to issue press releases saying, I want to get rid of the filibuster, I'm for X, Y, and Z, you know, preserving the filibuster still prevents them or makes it easier for them to say, look, I said I was for, you know, this and that good thing, but I just couldn't do it, right? That's how politics perpetuates status quo.
From your perspective of having worked in some of those Senate offices and congressional offices and frankly governor offices as well, if I remember correctly, how much of that is the like how much of that plays into this, right? Like that notion of like I come from a blue state. There's an expectation that I would be to get rid of the filibuster, and I have nobody in mind here. Maybe Chuck Schumer. But I have nobody in mind, and I come from a blue state. There's so much pressure on me to be, to come out for that. Joe's doing me a solid here, and down the road, I'll do Joe a solid. And I'm convinced that, you know, I don't know how many of those votes against the $15 minimum wage, Sanders amendment, which incidentally needed 60 votes to pass anyways. So all those Democrats could have voted for the minimum wage amendment and it still wouldn't have been amended. But you ended up getting 8 when really, you know, supposedly only 2 of them were on the fence about it.
That's right.
Although Chris Coons has some issue with like, you know, restaurants or something to that effect. How much of that was like, we're going to give cover to these guys because down the road, we're going to try and bring them into something else? Or how much, how conscious of that is that dynamic?
My view is that a lot of it is what isn't done versus what is done. And by that, I mean that if Manchin is willing to go out there and singularly stop filibuster reform, there is, in my view, there are certainly rank and file Democratic senators who may not be all that upset with that, even though they're issuing press releases saying, I really want to get rid of the filibuster, and are subsequently not necessarily willing to use what power they have to make life uncomfortable for him. This is the part of the story that's really not discussed, which is that, yes, Joe Manchin is doing the Democratic Party a solid, if you will, by being a Democratic senator from a tough red-leaning state, right? I mean, so we have to be careful about how much we pressure Joe Manchin because Joe Manchin represents a purple state. Well, the executive branch, as an example, has lots of power to discretionary power to decide where federal spending happens, where it doesn't happen. The different chair people of the Senate of committees have lots of discretionary power to decide whether Joe Manchin gets X, Y, or Z that he's demanding. So mobilizing that power to make it uncomfortable for Joe Manchin to continue being a problem on the filibuster, that's the part of this situation that's hard to see in real time, right? But when we say, you know, are people going up to Joe Manchin being like, hey man, I'm putting out press releases saying I'm for filibuster reform, but hey, thanks for doing that. I think it's more like Joe Manchin's going out there making filibuster reform impossible, and there's a bunch of Democrats who are like, maybe in their own minds, they're like, look, I don't actually have a problem with what he's doing. He's like doing me a solid here. And so like, I'm not going to like, if I'm chairman of some committee, the appropriations committee, I'm not going to like mess with his appropriation that he wants in West Virginia. I'm not going to like bring pressure to bear on him to actually move. And that goes all the way up to the White House, right? I mean, when we talked about the minimum wage situation, one of the things that we were writing about at the time was that any Democratic senator or any group of House members in a narrowly divided House could have said, listen, we're not supporting the American Rescue Plan unless it has a $15 minimum wage in here. We're going to be sort of an anti-Manchin, right? And the reason to do that is not to take down the bill, because it was a must-pass bill. I don't believe it would have been taken down. The reason to do that is to actually mobilize the White House to use its power to create a deal to bring pressure on the other side of the party, that you need to actually mobilize the tools of pressure. Joe Biden, as an example, I'm sure was like thrilled that he didn't have to actually really get off the sidelines on the $15 minimum wage, really get into the muck of like, okay, I got the progressives over here going to take down my bill if it has 15. Manchin's like saying he's going to mess with the bill if it has any minimum wage increase. I got to actually mobilize the tools of the White House to create an actual deal that puts something in here. I'm sure Biden was like, this is sweet. Like the progressives aren't threatening to take down the bill. I can just deal with Joe over here. I don't have to like get into the mess of this. And that's the way it's going to be until there is actually a need for the White House to actually mobilize those powers to actually push Joe Manchin. Now, will it have 100% success? Like, will it definitely move? Because you hear all the, oh, you know, even if the White House tried this whole idea, the president's powerless now, you know, like, we hear for 4 years, Donald Trump's the most powerful person in the world. Now, Joe Biden has no power. He can't do anything. He can't move. That's a lot of garbage. Will it be successful 100% of the time? No. Will it be successful sometimes? Yes.
How credible though? I mean, this is the difficulty, right? And this is the difficulty that, you know, we heard in the context of like the fiscal cliff at different times, you know, over the year. Like, how credible of a threat is it when, I don't know, pick whatever progressive you want in the Senate comes to Joe Biden and says like, I'm not going to vote for the rescue bill, unless we get the $15 minimum wage. And Biden goes, oh, really? I mean, really, like,
well, I mean, you're speaking to a point which is like, if you're going to make a threat, you have to be willing to follow through on it. And my view is that saying early, honestly, and upfront if there's a piece of, let's use the infrastructure bill, okay? The infrastructure bill. In my view, that the what the progressive should do, whether in the House or Senate, is say, here is what we need to be in this bill. We're going to say, we're not going to wait until the end to play a game to tell you, from the very beginning, it must have X, Y, and Z. If it doesn't have X, Y, and Z, we're out. Like, you just can't count. And we're going to say that early and upfront. And now it's your problem. Like, and a $15 minimum wage, as an example, is not some sort of like, you're not asking for something like insane or something like super radical. Like this, like we're asking our X, Y's and Z's are the things that you promised, right? So like, that's it. Like, that's where we are. And the progressives haven't been willing to do this. Now, here's a good historical analog where the Republicans did this. If you remember, it's a totally opposite issue, but if you remember during the bank bailouts, okay, the middle of the financial crisis, George Bush and like all of the most powerful people in the entire world through Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson come to Congress and are like, listen, the entire global economy is about to melt down for like the whole world is going to like literally explode unless you pass a 3-page bill giving the Treasury a complete blank check to spend whatever he wants at any time forever. Right. And the Republicans were basically like, we're not passing that bill. And they dug in, they drew a line, they said, we're not passing a bill that's like that. It's absolutely ridiculous. And then I'm sure Bernanke and Paulson were like, you can't be serious. You can't really be serious that you're going to follow through on this threat. And they followed through. And what happened? What happened was, is that a week later, they bring back a much bigger bill, a much longer bill, putting in at least some safeguards. Now, I was, the bill was still a joke. It was still an atrocity. But at least it was like, okay, like there's going to be a congressional oversight panel. There's going to be this. There's going to be that. And guess what? They voted it through because it was a must-pass situation. So the point is that the whole idea of like, we're going to create demands. And then if you don't meet the demands, we're not going to vote for this bill. And oh my God, you're going to take down the bill permanently. It's just belied by what actually probably would and could, certainly could happen, which is that the bill goes down, gets voted down. Guess what? Congress is still controlled by the Democrats. Guess what? The president is still a Democrat. You just bring back another bill and you have to actually deal with the people who made the demands and followed through.
Right. That is a great analogy. I remember that. And that was a must pass bill.
Yes.
I knew bankers who were telling their significant others at that time, take out every dollar you can at the ATM. Like there was a sense that the entire thing was going to fall down.
Yeah, so I'm not saying the Republicans were acting, the House Republicans were acting like in good faith or whatever, but like they understood power. They were like, we're just not, I'm sorry. Like you're going to have to put some things in here that we're demanding. Now their demands may have been like unprincipled or they didn't really believe in it or whatever, or they were just political showmanship, but like that's, at least at minimum, they showed an understanding of how power actually works.
Right. I for whatever reason, there is not. And I guess it's really just a question of like how many of Democratic senators are willing to do that. And
the answer right now.
Zero. Right.
Zero. Right now. I mean, and look, I want to be clear. It's worth saying, well, why aren't they willing to do this? Just because they're like weak. I think a lot of it is like they're just weak and scared, and there's even more nefarious. You know, they're not only are they weak and scared, they're complicit in actually not wanting these policies. But I think for the people who are acting in good faith, I think they struggle with like, look, there's a lot of good things in the American Rescue Plan. I'm afraid that if I go too hard, the progressive side of politics has never played this kind of hardball in the last 50 years. So like, what if we do this and we just ruin we blow it. Like we've miscalculated. And like, I get that. But like, at some point you have to like roll the dice.
Right. I mean, the fear is, and this is, I can understand this as a fear. Like, what if Joe Manchin just doesn't care and decides like, I, you know what? The Mitch McConnell came over and said, do I want to be chair of the energy? I'm going to be chair of two committees. And guess what? I'm a Republican now. Well, saw it happen to Jim Jeffords, saw it happen to Specter back in the day. Mm-hmm. And if I'm a Democratic senator, I'm going like, I want people to get $1,400, you know, or, you know, even though it wasn't 2000, whatever. And I want that $300 a month child tax credit. And that has a chance, if, you know, who knows, to maybe be made permanent. And if I get up there and say no $15 minimum wage, which, you know, some people are saying maybe we'll get another bite at this apple in a bit.
Well, but I mean, I think, look, that's why it's all about, frankly, mobilizing Biden. And we'll go back to the $15 minimum wage thing. I think that what could, here's an alternate reality that I don't think is like insane, right? You had 10, 15, 20 House Democrats say we can't vote for this unless it's got $15 minimum wage. Manchin saying, I don't want anything. I would accept 11.
Right.
Kristen Sinema is from a state that's got 12. If the progressives say we can't vote for this without some sort of minimum wage increase in it, you've now created the conditions for Biden to swoop in and be like, hey, listen, here's what we're going to do. We're going to at least do 13. Okay. We're going to, and I'm not saying I'd be happy with 13, like 15, you know, you need 15 or whatever, or at least you'd get Biden. Listen, I can't give you 15. I can't give you a minimum wage increase in this, but I am committing that in the underlying bill of my infrastructure bill that's coming right after this, there's going to be $15 in there. At least you get like a commitment, like something concrete, anything. Like they walked out of the American Rescue Plan with like a night, like maybe we'll do $15 at some point later. You know, there was nothing because, and there was nothing because there wasn't a negotiation. There was not a demand that was made.
Do you think the infrastructure bill has the same level of urgency that this could be leveraged in the same way?
Well, that's a great question. And that's actually the problem. Oh, you know, it's so interesting because the American Rescue Plan's necessity, the emergency that was happening and the need to pass it was cited as a reason to not push too hard for a $15 minimum wage. But in fact, the way power works is that that's gives you the precisely the best chance to actually make it happen because it absolutely had to pass. And rank and file members of Congress knew it had to pass no matter what was in it, right? That's the whole, like, I work for the House Appropriations Committee, right? The House Appropriations Committee, when I worked for it, there was like a sort of this standing understanding that because the budget bills have to pass, they are a moving train, they must pass to fund all the basic things of government, that anything you could like toss on to the moving train would probably pass no matter how like kind of crazy or insane it was, because you need the, you know, you don't want to be accused of, oh, you're standing against the troops or oh, you're standing against public schools or whatever. That the point is that the people who understood the process the best back then, who got so many things done through that process, were people who understood that the more acutely the nation needs a piece of legislation and that rank and file members feel like they have to pass a piece of legislation, the more you should actually try to put your initiatives onto that legislation, because that gives it the best chance of actually happening.
Right. Right. And so it's unclear whether this infrastructure
correct. Yes.
Has that same sort of compulsion. And that's the problem, is that you get one of those must pass bills rarely.
That's
and
right.
Really, I mean, and that, you know, God help me for quoting Rahm Emanuel,
yes.
But you don't want to let you know, a crisis can be an opportunity type of situation.
Yes, we share the same mind, because that was literally the quote that when you were saying that went through my mind too.
Right, and it's so distasteful to even have him to raise his name. Although I will say, in my defense, I think it was one of those like corporate posters that it was like a Chinese character. And,
oh, totally. Oh, look, and by the way, every crisis is an opportunity. Go back to the TARP bill.
Right.
Yes, every crisis, it was an opportunity to bail out the banks, right? It could have been an opportunity to bail out America. Instead, it was an opportunity to bail out, like, you know, Lloyd Blankfein and Goldman Sachs.
Indeed, indeed. And all right, so let's talk about just a little bit about, so, and it still just, I guess, remains to be seen as to what Joe Manchin's doing. I for one, don't think his op-ed locks him in the way that other people are saying it is, because I don't think anybody, like, that op-ed is not for people in West Virginia.
No, no.
Like, it's not. There's no scenario where Joe Manchin's Republican opponent says, look what you wrote in the Washington Post about filibuster. Now, then you went in there and did a talking filibuster. It's either, there's one of two things. It's either he wants, you know, the Joe Manchin Civic Center in West Virginia, and that's going to be part of the earmark in whatever bill it is. Or he's been told by his donors, like, there's some votes in there we don't want you to take. And this is the, and he's like, this is the way I don't take that vote.
Look, there's certainly an out. I mean, for him, I this is a guy who has made clear he's willing to be on different sides of an issue when he perceives it to be, you know, in his interest. Certainly you can imagine 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months from now, something happens. He can say, listen, I didn't, you know, I've the Republicans did X. We need to pass X. And like the only way to do it is that I'm not saying he's going to do this, but I'm saying there's a way for him to be on the other side of this like next week.
Easy. I mean, he said no, under no circumstance, but then you could say like, it was a failure of imagination. I just couldn't come up with the circumstance.
Exactly.
So with that said, 2 days ago, and it was a day before a Manchin put this out. So possibly Chris Coons, Reuters reported that Chris Coons said, we're going to give until the end of May to the Republicans, and then we're going to do this alone. And when Chris Coons says that, he's speaking for Joe Biden.
Absolutely. Right?
And so the way this works in terms of pressure, Joe Manchin doesn't care if anybody listening to this interview, you know, sends an email to Joe Manchin or a letter and says, you've got to vote for the filibuster. Joe Manchin cares if Joe Biden comes in and says, hey, man, you know, look, you know, I'm the Joe's president. You're the Joe's senator. We got to do this.
Yeah.
How does that happen? How do we pressure Biden to like where or do they feel that pressure and they're figuring it out?
So my guess is if my I guess positive, optimistic view is that so many things will end up piling up. Like the House will pass all of these initiatives. The Senate will make a spectacle of trying to pass a bunch of initiatives, including, you know, voting rights and the infrastructure bill and all of Biden's stated priorities. And there will just be this backlog sitting in the Senate with 50 votes, 50 Democratic votes cast for them, but can't get through. And then the pressure will be on Joe Biden the question will be like, where are you? What are you going to do now? What will try to diffuse the situation, and I think that pressure would be that sort of conflict, that crescendo will be where that's what you need to actually break the filibuster. But short of that, what you will see is an effort to try to use reconciliation to insist that the filibuster isn't necessarily needed. But again, the problem with that is, in my view, you can, again, as an opponent of the filibuster,
right,
you can say, we want to preserve the filibuster, but we're going to use reconciliation in an aggressive way. The what makes the situation untenable, truly, is we have the filibuster and we're going to use reconciliation, but continue to pretend that the parliamentarian can basically render reconciliation much weaker than it needs to be. Like, in other words, if you're going to go with the whole idea that we can sort of circumvent this through this ridiculous process, then you have to, at minimum, be willing to like aggressively use that process and not pretend that the parliamentarian can block any, that the parliamentarian is effectively a filibuster, right? Like, one of those things has to change, right? And so my guess is that if they don't really want to get rid of the filibuster, that this whole parliamentarian issue is going to have to change. Otherwise, like what's going to happen? Like, all these things are going to pile up. The Democrats are going to insist that they can't do anything about it.
Voting.
Nothing is going to get through. The Republicans will make a whole thing about how the Democrats, you know, and by the way, don't underestimate the Republicans creating gridlock and then also criticizing gridlock. Like, they're the ones making sure nothing is happening. And then they'll bash the Democrats for not getting anything done.
All right. Look, I know you have a hard out in a couple of minutes, so I just want to go over this quickly. Andrew Cuomo is under siege in about four different ways. He's got the sexual harassment charges. He's got he moved and covered up the deaths in nursing homes. And you guys wrote a story, I don't know how many, 4 or 5 months ago was it? I can't even remember when it was.
Almost a year ago.
Okay. Saying that drawing the line between Cuomo signing a bill basically to say no liability for these nursing homes and for hospitals, you can't sue them for anything that they do in these practices, and ended up getting some nice campaign contributions. Quite a coincidence.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a coincidence. Yeah, I mean, our story was basically, we broke open the story that one of his biggest donors, a healthcare industry lobby group, pumped about $2 million into his political machine. And he slipped provisions into the New York State budget, this giant budget bill, right? Like a couple lines into the budget bill, extending liability protections from frontline nursing home workers and medical workers, right? Nobody disputes that that's legit, like the doctors, nurses, extending them explicitly to healthcare industry executives, CEOs, corporate board members, and the like. The people who are making the decisions about staffing, the people who are making the actual decisions about how a nursing home runs. He extended liability protections to them. And the group that gave him money bragged that it drafted the provision. So think about this for a second. The pandemic is happening. People are getting sick and dying in nursing homes. He slips legislation into the budget, shielding the corporate executives from lawsuits and the deterrent, by the way. That's the key thing, is that a corporate decision maker is going to be less inclined to make cost-cutting, dangerous decisions if they know at minimum they could face a lawsuit. He shields them from that right after he's taken a big amount of money. And then he's withholding the data about the explosion of deaths in these facilities. I mean, this is one of the most corrupt and tragic, really, truly tragic situations that's happened. And we reported a series of stories about how then that legislation in New York, the provisions were copied and pasted in other states, like word for word. Mitch McConnell copied and pasted that liability immunity section from New York, put it into the Republicans' plan. So this was a terrible situation. And we also reported a story about how, you know, months later, families who had lost family members, they were being stripped of their legal rights. They couldn't get legal representation because no lawyer wanted to take their case. Now, this story has a good ending. I mean, you know, at least a silver lining. I mean, 15,000 people died. That you can't fix that. But New York legislators, Ron Kim, Senator Alessandro Biaggi, a bunch of other progressives who were kind of against the Cuomo machine, they ended up successfully passing legislation to repeal the corporate immunity. And Cuomo actually, I think it was a couple of days ago, was essentially shamed into signing a repeal of his own corrupt law. So in a sense, I mean, you can't really like celebrate, like, yay, like, you know, 15,000 people are dead, so you're not really celebrating. But actually, like, it's like one of the first times I can remember where like something wildly corrupt happened, like wildly, like grotesquely corrupt, with awful human circumstances. And actually the process, now granted there were other, you know, Cuomo's facing all sorts of scandals, so I'm sure that sort of helped weaken him, but actually they repealed it. So there is a kind of a silver lining there.
Yep, and we'll talk more about that. I know you got to go. David Sirota, The Daily Poster. Folks should go over and sign up for your emails. It is, like I say, I end up citing it at least once a week on this program. David, always a pleasure to catch
Thanks,
up.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. It's great to see you. Thanks again. Bye.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. We'll talk on the other end about, you know, what's happening in New York State. That and it's fascinating. I would have loved more time to talk to David about just sort of how weakening Andrew Cuomo has fundamentally altered the New York State politics and what the implications could be across the country for that as well. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back and wrap up this week. Right back after this. We are back. Let's play this clip. This is just, we were talking about Joe Manchin earlier about his op-ed, and this he is trying to make an argument that somehow we can, that the existence of total polarization is reason why you should not react to the total polarization that exists. This is clip number one, Joe Manchin on CNN trying to justify. This is pretty impressive.
Capital.
January 6th changed me, and I was very clear with everybody. I never thought in my life, I never read in history books, to where our form of government had been attacked at our seat of government, which is Washington, D.C., at our capital, by our own people. Now, the British did it, but not Americans. So something told me, wait a minute, pause, hit the pause button, something's wrong. You can't have this many people split to where they want to go to war with each other.
So to be clear, he is saying that because there were Republican lawmakers who were essentially ginning up enough hostility towards the American government that people attacked the Capitol, therefore, we should not have filibuster reform because I'm going to rely on these same Republican lawmakers to reach across the aisle and work together with us and assume that we have the same agenda. I mean, it is so just, I don't know who Joe Manchin thinks is buying this, you know, because not everybody's paying attention. The people who are paying attention know what he's saying is absolute jibber jabber. It's ridiculous. It's fascinating to me. But that's that. Well, here's Jim Clyburn response.
He says if I remember your interview, that January 6th changed him. Well, it changed me as well. And I want to remind him of what some of those insurrectionists were saying to those African-American law officers who were out there. One man talking about how many times he was called the N-word. I want to know, how does that man compromise in such a situation? How would he have me compromise in such a situation?
I mean, you know. That's basically the point. Like, where do you see the partner in governance here as you look across the aisle? If that is the problem that you note, what happened on January 6th. But getting back to the implications of all these scandals surrounding Andrew Cuomo, the New York government has basically decided to up taxes on the super wealthy in this state. And it is the first time this has happened in ages. It is a $212 billion budget for the coming fiscal year. It is $79 billion larger than the governor's first budget. There's some of that is federal stimulus money, but also tax increases on people who've done exceedingly well, not just this past year, but in general, at a time where New York State desperately needs funding for schools, for public hospitals, for Medicaid. So part of the reporting that Sirota did, part of the push that activists have been doing for years have led to this sort of situation where this, the fact that Cuomo is mired in scandal has weakened him politically. And it's to the benefit of the citizens of New York State. It is just a sort of a gross dynamic, frankly. But in the end, it's going to have material benefits for people in their daily lives. Something to ruminate on over the course of the weekend. With that, we will say goodbye to you if you're watching just the first hour of the show. And we will see you on Monday. And for those of you sticking around, we will see you. We continue to see you. You're seen. We will head into the fun half of the program, wherein Matthew Film Guy will be joining us. And we will talk movies. We got a lot of clips. Boy, Emma's going to be bummed she missed some of these Dave Rubin clips.
I'm going to let Matthew in because I think he has something he might want to plug before we go into the fun half. He's got a new film series, Zoom film series coming up.
He has used a picture of Thanos, I see. Yeah. There he is, Matthew Film Guy. Matthew, we'll let you have your plug in just one second. Let me just remind people, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get access to the free show free of commercials. You also get the fun half. So you'll hear Matthew Film Guy's movie recommendations. Oh, wait a second. Are we going to go into the fun? Are we going to just... No. We're not going to keep you square. I guess we'll do that afterwards. Nevertheless.
I used to get to be on the regular half, but you know what? Times change.
You'll get to... You'll be on the regular half. We'll let you on the regular half today.
I'm not on the Peacock show, but listen, let's not get greedy.
Yeah, we're not doing entertainment on the Peacock show.
I'll say.
JoinTheMajorityReport.com. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. Also, don't forget JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. Use the coupon code Majority, get 10% off. And also AM Quickie. And Matt, I heard you had a great guest on last night.
Yeah, Nathan Bernard on to talk about Maine med nurses who are unionizing, and there's a unabashed liberal union buster that was sent in to stop them who had previously worked with Trump International in Las Vegas. So we only use the most progressive union busters, folks. We talked about that last night. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get the full show, but you can get the free stuff at YouTube, Left Reckoning. Go subscribe to that.
Matthew Film Guy, what have you got going? Wait, did you get a haircut?
Did I have the giant Hasidic beard last time I was on? You know, I've only had two haircuts in the entire pandemic, so I finally had the guts to go into public and get it chopped. So yeah, thank you.
Wow, that's pretty good. So what do you want to plug before we get on with the talk here?
You know, my normal stuff that I'm plugging, everyone should go to my eBay and check out my eBay at Langdon Boom. And but primarily, I want to just invite more people to come join our film appreciation class that I do over Zoom. We've been doing it since the pandemic started. It originally started, if you remember, at the Queens JCC, which is now called the Common Point Queens Community Center. But now that the pandemic is on, we've been doing it over Zoom. And we've actually gotten a few really great new members to the class, thanks to the Majority Report. Shout out to Jonathan and Dan, and also to Julie.
My sister's takes your class.
That's right. None other than Julie Cedar herself is one of our new students, relatively new, but it's been a while. She's awesome. And it's been a great bunch of new people, new blood coming in. And we watch, you know, the kind of movies that I like to talk about. Difficult movies, movies that require a little bit more thinking and a little bit more discussion. And I always get a lot of really great stuff out of the things that people say to me that I learn things about these movies from the class. So please come and join us. You can go check my Twitter at Langdon Boom. And there's a link there. Matt just retweeted it. Thank you, Matt. And you can come and check out the kinds of movies that you want a group mind to help to process and to really get through. We send you the movie on the link, and then we meet once a week and we have a hour and a half, 2 hours or so discussion. Sometimes discussions are so hot and so wonderful that they just wind up going over. So come join us, please. And tell them that Sam Cedar sent you.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. So Matthew Film Guy, you have gotten your second haircut. You've trimmed your beard. I have yet to get a haircut during the pandemic.
Really?
Yeah. No, I will sit here and I will look in the camera, and if something's sticking out, I just cut it.
Oh, okay. So you've actually applied scissors to hair. This isn't just what it's been for a year. No. Yeah.
I've got one of those big razor things and I do that, but I haven't gone to haircut anywhere. I mean, I can't even tell you what the back of my head looks like. It's probably not good.
Well, yeah, and you've got like I always like to tell you, you've got a lot more to work with than I do. So I need a professional's touch. I can't just mess around and hope I'm going to turn out well.
Well, I'm glad you're here because I'll play this clip with you because it's film related. Dave Rubin had Tim Pool on. When did this happen? Do we know when this was? Is this recent?
I believe so. Yes.
You believe so? Okay. Here is Tim Pool and Dave Rubin. We got this from what is it? The Rubin clips or what is that?
Yeah, Dave Rubin clips.
Clips Dave.
Clips Dave.
Yeah, and they are talking about is there another Avengers movie coming? Is that possible?
I assume there's just going
to
be.
It's safe to say. Yeah.
It's on rails, yeah.
At any point, you can ask that question, and the answer is yeah.
I don't know if it was like this was way back. I have a feeling this was a while back, where Dave Rubin and Tim Pool sat down together. But apparently, there is an actress in these movies. Whoa! What did you just do? You changed your camera?
Yeah, I like widescreen. I look better in widescreen.
An actress in these movies, Brie Larson, and my understanding is she plays Captain Marvel.
Yes, Captain Marvel.
These guys are talking about Infinity.
The white Captain Marvel, you should say.
Right. They're talking about Infinity Wars. Now, there's two things that are going on here. One is that Dave Rubin and Tim Pool are practicing cancel culture, and the other is that they think Infinity Wars is a good movie. So let's play this clip.
It's going to be like a moderately good Marvel film. I just don't like Brie Larson because she's very snooty and condescending. I'm going to sit this one out.
Yeah.
There are some people
who are.
That's
completely how I feel. I love all the Marvel movies. Right. Love them. Infinity War was, I think, the best one.
That was great.
Yeah.
I'm so excited for it.
The best one. I can't wait for the next one. And I have no desire to see it because I saw her little speech. And it's like, you know what? I just don't want to support you. If we keep supporting these people who are so contrary to at least the things that I believe in, it's like the only way you're going to ever get change. Because I don't want the government to stop them. I want them to stop themselves.
But so here's the thing. I don't feel that way. Yeah.
So I guess that was 2 years ago because this is before End War or whatever it is.
End Game
or whatever. Is it End Game or End War? I don't know what it is. But
it's End Game. Don't pretend like you don't know.
How does someone? I watched Infinity Wars since this clip. That's what made me. In addition to it's you know. Dave Rubin is actively promoting cancel culture, right? Where you don't like what she's saying and you'll not go to a movie, I guess.
He wants them to stop themselves.
Stop themselves. Cancel, self-cancel. How does anybody think that movie is good? Infinity War?
Sam, what are you doing to me here? Seriously.
Come on.
What are you doing to me here? No. Look, when you say the word movie, right, or film, it can take on so many different forms, from the stupidest version of the TV movie of the week to the highest achievement of the human soul and the ability to penetrate the eternal. Okay, so when you want to put that on a continuum, do I go watch the Marvel movies? Yes, I do. Do I maybe have some sort of opinions about them? Sure, I enjoy them very much. I read comic books when I was, you know, from 5 until like 17. So they have a place in our society. But this is freaking ridiculous. I mean, what... Okay, go on.
Now, wait a second. Now, I agree with you. Like, my movie tastes run the gamut. But this movie is objectively bad. One scene replayed over and over again.
Listen, if you took out all the smashing and all the crazy cartoon violence, they would be like a 45-minute movie. So I'm with you. I'm with you on that. But listen, I can't believe you're putting me in the position of having to defend the Marvel movies. But I enjoyed the Infinity movies. I enjoy them. I'm able to give myself
Endgame, I can understand. You know, like Captain America number 1 and 2, Winter Soldier, I can understand. You know, like maybe Iron Man 1 or 2. But the Infinity War is just like a bunch of just a gobbledygook. I mean, you've got to get each stupid die.
It's all gobbledygook. You want a bad guy to fight a good guy, and then for it to seem like he's going to lose, and then he wins. Like, how many, how, it's not a...
Like 12 times in the movie. Like, they just keep replaying the same scene over again.
Do you like Chinese food, Sam? Do you eat it 12 times and you enjoy it 12 times? You know, there's something, there's comfort food. There's something just base that you can just enjoy in that movie.
I can have 12 meals literally in a row in the course of an hour.
You're going to eat 12 bites. I could continue this metaphor. But listen, look, one thing I'll tell you this is, I can't believe I'm going to be serious about a Marvel movie here. Thank you, Sam. One thing I can tell you is it's something that the comic books that were written from the 60s through until I read them in the 90s, one thing that they had to build on that any other form didn't really have was the fact that they existed for years, and they set up such a world, such a number of details and depth of these stories. Now depth, they're stupid stories, but they had such a history to build on that they could use that history to tell something of a greater story by the end. That's what these movies did. Is they spent trillions of dollars of all these movies to have something that basically paid off in that last movie. But what's the point of all that? You don't need me, Matthew, the film guy, to come on here and tell you that the Avengers movies are good movies. They're because they do what they do. They're mindless entertainment, and I enjoy them for what they are. But I mean, someone needs to be advocating for something other than that. That gets enough press, don't you think, Sam? And Dave Rubin and who's it, Tim Pool? They're a couple of freaking idiots, and you know that, and I know that, and they're trying to just shoehorn their own cultural hobby horses into this conversation about Brie Larson because they're not going to watch her. Look, I don't want to watch a Kevin Sorbo movie or whatever, you know. Far be it for me to blame them for boycotting what they don't like.
First off, if there was a series of Kevin Sorbo movies that I thought were great, that I would talk about, and then like the idea that it was Kevin Sorbo, listen, I'm not going to not go back and watch some of those spaghetti westerns with Clint Eastwood. You know my relationship with Clint Eastwood in movies.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to like that.
Also, because he's was a moron talking to a chair.
Right.
You know, I'm still going to watch those spaghetti westerns. I'm going to show them to Saul when he's old enough.
Mm-hmm. I don't blame anyone either way. Listen, there's a large argument about where you separate the art from the artist, and especially if something, you know, was done before whatever this artist did was objectively offensive. But, you know, again, Dave Rubin and Tim Pool, I mean, come on, that was not film criticism. That was mutual cultural masturbation on a web show, which I will not engage in with you.
Matthew, do you have a Snyder cut take? Speaking of artists, I don't. I'm not going to watch 4 hours of a superhero movie, but
listen,
Snyder cut.
Pandemic Matthew has watched a lot of shit, okay, if I may curse. Wait, this time last year, I was watching Knight Rider, if you remember. Okay.
Yeah, Sam needs a brief.
The other giant comic book company, DC, they make movies. That's Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman. And those movies have not been nearly as successful. And apparently they took away the original director. They fired the original director, this guy, Zack Snyder, who got famous making these kind of bombastic kind of, you know, boobs and guns kind of action movies.
300, right? Is that
300? Yeah. A fascist. It's clearly a fascist ethos, but at least it has an ethos. So I give it credit for that. But, you know, and they took away his vision, and the fans, rebelled and said, we want his original cut. And they gave it to Joss Whedon, who's got his own problems.
What movie did Snyder direct?
The Justice League. They tried to do their same series of things. There was a Superman movie, then there was Batman versus Superman, and then there was, I can't believe I'm talking about this. Okay, but anyway, they then now finally came out with a 4-hour version.
Superman was horrible, I heard.
Yeah. And they came out with another version of that one, too. Listen, I watched them all. OK, here I am to tell you that I watched them all. I watched all the remakes. And listen, what do I want out of this movie? What are people complaining about? You get some Batman fighting Superman and they realize that it was Lex Luthor the whole time.
What? Spoiler alert.
What? Yeah. Oh, Lex Luthor's the villain. I thought, you know, what's his name from social?
Jesse Eisenberg was
Jesse Eisenberg. Yeah, it was ridiculous. It was the most showy, ticky performance of all time. But listen, I want some laser eyes. That's what I want from a Superman movie. I don't care about story. I want laser eyes, you know, heat vision. So I watched all 4 hours, Matt. And listen, I dug it. I don't remember hating the original one. I watched it, but it goes in one ear and out the other. It's all mindless.
But like that trilogy, I think is quite good.
Well, that's the Sam. That's the arty Batman movies. That's a Christopher Nolan, the thinking man's fascist. Yeah. You know, that's the. So all right, yeah, I give those credit. They achieve something a little bit different, but you know, these are comfort food. These are just like, you know, again, what I enjoyed when I was 8. Now I'm still enjoying it when I'm 45. It's like if there was ever a guilty pleasure for a film guy like myself, it's these movies. But
he's old enough. Some of those spaghetti westerns, he's got to be.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Well, I then you know, listen, once when I was a teenager and I. You know, started to become more interested in just the world movies. And like Quentin Tarantino was a huge fan of spaghetti westerns. I saw a ton of those. I watched like a ton of Hong Kong action movies, spaghetti westerns, all the international stuff. There's literally thousands. Carbucci, Sergio Leone. I mean, there's just, it's infinite. There's still more on my list that I would still watch today. They have charms. They have interesting things about them. But they're teenage boy movies, and there's still the teenage boy inside me. Sometimes he's very close to the surface, but these are not the movies that I think necessarily are need my vocal appreciation.
I understand. This is off brand for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, I got a wide panoply. We don't show the Marvel movies or the superhero movies in my film class at Common Points Queens on Zoom. Go to my Twitter, Langdon Boom, and sign up today.
Do you have these? Are these movies listed in your, what is it, boxed stub?
You can go to my Letterboxd and see the crap mixed with the high art that I put together there. Go to Letterboxd, no E in Boxed, you know, like Tumblr or Sam Grindr, you know, these sites that you would know. But there's a list there, a diary that I keep, and you can follow along with what I'm watching, and you'll see it varies, and I'm honest about what I enjoy, so I make no apologies for liking those movies. But you know, when you come on as you're trying to advocate for a certain kind of film that needs a little bit more time to be talked about, I tend to eschew those. But actually, to be honest, yesterday, I'll tell you this, I got my second vaccine and it kind of kicked my ass yesterday.
What did you which one did you get?
I got the Pfizer.
Oh yeah. That's why Emma's not here, actually. It's because she
I wondered about that. Yeah. I had a fever, and so I just curled up and I watched two like glorified TV movies. I watched Silkwood, about Karen Silkwood, and the Mike Nichols movie. Decent politics, basically a TV movie. But then I watched Thinking of You, I watched The Great Santini. So that's a movie that, yeah, you reference it so many times that I've never seen it. It's one of these cultural lexicon films that, not a great movie, kind of cliche, but I think it's added something to the cultural lexicon so important that I felt I had to watch it. So you can go look on my Letterbox and see that I watched that. Yeah. But you can also see that I watched DC animated movies and so on. Matt.
Now you can see like why when I play basketball with Saul, I bang the ball across his head and say squirt a few out. That's why I do that.
I learned something about you, I think, from watching this movie, and that was my goal to have done that yesterday.
Santini is not a great movie, but it's a great movie to get across a point, right? Because it's such like a sort of dimensional portrait. It
captures an archetype that I think is useful in conversation to say like, oh, you're being like that, you know,
that whole era of movie making where you had like ordinary people and
terms of endearment.
And there was all of these sort of like,
you know,
it was a very interesting time where you like suddenly it was when there was this sort of like, we're going to be frank about the dynamic of families. And I thought that was all very interesting era. I mean, and not particularly great, but
you'll see my reviews. I leave little blurbs, sometimes more elaborate than others, on the Letterbox, but they were basically glorified TV movies, a little bit more well done than your average sort of movie of the week at the time. But, you know, it's kind of cliche and you kind of can tell where it's going and a little bit ham fisted. But, you know, the pandemic has led me down a lot of weird roads because I've had a little bit of extra time on my hands, and it's caused me to sort of do some weird weird sets of movies. Like I watched like every movie about Van Gogh that I could find. And some of those are amazing. You know, the artist Vincent Van Gogh, have you heard of him? Oh, he's a Dutch painter from the late 1800s. He's one of the greatest artists of all time, Sam.
You mean Van Gogh?
Van Gogh. It's what's interesting is to follow along how they pronounce his name differently in all the movies. Van Gogh, Van Gogh, Van Gogh, or Van Gogh. But, you know, I was raised in the ridiculously false American version of his name. But yes, Matt, thank you. Van Gogh. Lust for Life. Also, Maurice Pialat's Van Gogh, I could really recommend that one. Go on, Sam.
Interesting. I have to say that I am a little bit jealous on some level of people who have more time during the pandemic. I haven't watched anything. I haven't even had time to, like, you know. Thank gosh, Survivor's not on because I wouldn't even have time to watch it. I'd be bummed.
You could walk away from the show at any time.
I did.
Just walk away. Just drop it.
I am obligated to watch it. But I've caught up on things like Sandlot 1, Sandlot 2, Sandlot 3.
Cute.
Those now, and that's been good. Yes. No, the only movies I watch are generally now with Saul. So I just keep waiting for him to get old enough to like, so we can watch the Bourne movies and Bond movies so he can really appreciate them. I feel like
my dad was Bond and like Indiana Jones and these kinds of movies.
Jones, he likes those. But, you know, I want him to appreciate them a little bit more than he's capable of at this point. So with that said, Matthew, what would you recommend, you know, that is actually like, you know, You've basically, you know, I made you comment on, you know, the fast food industry, but now you're here to give us a recipe and perhaps a little tasting, more of a gourmand perspective on film. Now that you,
I just
In-N-Out Burger or whatever it is you just told us or something like that. Yeah. So.
Yeah, but I just want to be clear. This isn't like the three little pieces of food on the plate with the design around it that you're like, you know, where Steve Martin said, oh, I'm finished and I don't even remember having eaten in L.A. Story. It's not that. I'm not kind of giving you that. I'm trying to give you something hearty and something delicious prepared well by an authentic chef, not some pretentious.
Oh, I want to ask you while you're saying that, incidentally, reminds me to ask you, like, what people are dying to know, like the follow up, like what happens when you have such a successful movie like Black Bear that you edited? What happens after something like that?
Well, first, then a global pandemic hits.
Right.
The entire industry shuts down. And what you get an agent right before that happens, and they don't talk to you for like 8 months because there's nothing to say.
Of course.
And then slowly around this time, they start saying, oh, things are coming back on. We're submitting you for things, and we're definitely going to have you doing your next project this year. So that seems to be what the case is. I'm actually editing a short film right now that's kind of just more like for fun. But yes, that is where that career trajectory is headed right at this moment. I've applied for a couple other things, grants and fellowships and things like that, based on, you know, what notoriety I've had here. My San Diego Film Critics Award nomination has carried me very far.
Congratulations.
Did I not tell you that? Oh, thank you.
Not aware of that. That's congratulations. It is.
Thank you. That was nice.
Classic. It is classic. Hollywood showbiz story of editing a film and then having a pandemic hit and having the industry shut down. Classic. Yeah.
Well, I try to be traditional. You know me, I like to stick to the sort of the rails that are already there for me. Sam, I'm just thinking out loud here. Have you ever seen the movie SOB?
I don't think I have.
Okay, because it's like I wanted to do a film festival of all the Hollywood I don't know what you want to call it, like satires. This was Blake Edwards did it in 1981. I feel like Who's the Caboose is right in there. So I just wondered if you had ever seen SOB, because it is definitely like an incisive parody of the the Hollywood mentality from the early 80s.
I remember the when you say Blake Edwards, it makes me feel like I remembered a little bit, but I don't think I did see it.
He's a director who like gets terrible reviews on his first weekend, and he's like reading the trades and he feels suicidal. But then he has like a kind of like a psychic break, and he like thinks like, I got to reshoot this whole movie, and they spend the weekend reshooting it. And it's like, you know, it's a slapstick kind of comedy.
Okay. No, I didn't know it.
I think you'd like that. Which, by the way, did you like Tony Erdman that I recommended last time I was on?
Tony Erdman? I tried to get Saul to watch it. He would not watch it.
It's probably not. You wait another like 30 years, 25 years, and I think he'd be ready to watch that. All right. So what do I have for you? What do I have for you this week? A film that we actually showed in the film appreciation class that I do on Zoom. Go to Twitter/Langdon Boom and you can sign up for that show, that class, to talk movies with us. And it is a semi-personal, semi-political documentary. So I think it's a great one for the Majority Report crowd. It is called Camera Person. And it is shot by, directed by Kristen Johnson, or is it, I think it's Kirsten Johnson, if I don't want to mispronounce her name. But it's very interesting because Kirsten Johnson was a DP, a director of photography, the camera person, for dozens and dozens of political documentaries. She worked with Laura Poitras a lot. She did a lot of things for like Frontline and Independent Lens and these kinds of political documentaries. Well, so what she did was she took a lot of the footage that were sort of like outtakes and like little snippets from all of these films across, I don't know, something like 20 years of doing these. And she was able to assemble them, in which, as an editor, a feat of editing I could really appreciate, into essentially an autobiographical film. So there's a few little bits of like home movie footage of hers, but it's like just little moments she captures. And it's like, it's one of these really mind-bending movies that's creating a new sort of language of how to understand the movie as it happens, because it seems to be sort of ambient, but then you, as it goes on, you sort of can tell what the story is just by the order of shots. And it goes from, you know, interviews she did with like Jacques Derrida, the philosopher, to like shots she does in Darfur and all these different political hotspots. She goes back to a village in Bosnia a couple times that she was covering. And it really is hard to explain how amazing this movie is just in the way it tells the story. And this is what I'm really looking for in these kinds of movies I show in my class. Movies that play with the form, that push the form forward, that sort of expand on what you think a movie can be. And it's really breathtaking and it's really impressive. And I recommend it to everybody. It's got a kind of a political and a personal sort of through line throughout it. And it's called Camera Person by Kirsten Johnson.
That sounds fascinating. I think it's almost like a found footage film, but not quite.
Yeah, well, it's found footage from her, from jobs that she has shot. So she's the one who shot this film, but it's outtakes. And you'll see at the end of the credits, like, this was from this film, this was from this film. So yeah, it is like a found footage film. I don't know if anybody knows the Chris Marker film Sans Soleil. It's sort of like a staple of the genre of these sort of not found footage, but sort of collage films. He was a French filmmaker that came out in the early 80s. I also showed that in my class. It's sort of in that vein, but she puts her own very personal touch to it. And it's a lot more humanistic than his film. It's more revealing, more personal.
I thought you were going to something as soon as you started to talk about that. It reminded me of like Look Out Haskell, It's Real, right? The doc.
Yeah. Medium cool. Yeah. It's got some flavor of that, although that was sort of like they shot a fake movie. They went to an event knowing it was happening to shoot a documentary, and some were dramatic. Some elements were dramatized. But anyway, yeah, well, go check out. If you're done with all the Marvel movies and you're done with all the Justice League movies, check out Camera Person in a quiet moment for some really amazing cinema.
Well, Matthew Film Guy, you will be happy to know that I received a word during the course of this interview that my sister is re-upping for the next session.
Nice.
Another happy customer. Folks can check out Matthew's stuff at Langdon Boom on all of it. Yeah, whatever.
Letterboxd and Twitter. Sam, I just have one last little question before you let me go. Are you aware that Marc Maron named his cat after you?
I was aware of that. I don't know if you noticed on Twitter.
Did you tweet it?
Yeah, I tweeted at him. I said, thank you. He didn't respond.
I didn't notice that, but I did hear that he named his cat Sammy, and I think that's the highest compliment, even though he doesn't, you know, I'm sure talk to you very much. There you go, a message from Mark. Sweet.
No, he didn't even acknowledge that I had tweeted that.
I'm sure he loved hearing it, though.
Yeah, no, I bet you he did, of course. Well, Matthew, film guy, as always, a real pleasure. And thank you for
joining
us. And we hope to see you soon. I'm glad you shaved.
Thank you, Sam. Good luck. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Now, folks, we will head into the fun half. You can join us there by becoming a member. We'll take your phone calls, maybe 646-257-3920. At the very least, we'll read your IMs. See you in just a moment. Since you left you,